Out in the fields towards the woods, maybe half a mile distant, we could glimpse them moving from copse to copse and between small hamlets and farmsteads. There are a lot more of them now. They are not pursued us at once, as it seemed they had wanted to gather their whole strength. There was silence in the company as we walked along, each of us counting their numbers. 40, I think, Lila said, squinting. Cuthbert shook his head. No, I count nearer 50. I believe Cuthbert, whose sight, like his archery, was acute and accurate. So then, there were 50 horsemen keeping pace with us and moving ahead, and perhaps 40 spearmen following up on foot. We still outnumbered them, but we had many wounded and sick with us, as well as many women and children who would not or could not fight. Our only hope was to reach the ford over the river Wharfe before them. I ran ahead to the front of the column. Edward and Grettir had seen the horsemen too, and were, despite my earlier orders to keep it slow, pushing the pace as fast as they could. I looked ahead to see if I could see the river. At first I could not, due to the trees and hedgerows blocking the view. But we then passed over the crest of a small hill, and there, half a mile away amongst marshes and woodlands, lay the river like a dark green ribbon. I looked over to the horsemen, and thought we might manage to reach it ahead of them.
"Master Curdick, look that way," Grettir urged me.
He was pointing towards the horsemen. "Yes, I see them, Grettir. I'm not blind," I snapped, in an irritated voice.
"No, the other side of them."
I looked beyond the horsemen. The small hill we were on gave us the advantage to see a long way, and the woods had now become sparser and given way to open meadows, so we could see many miles to the west. It was hazy, but I could pick out the long brown ribbon of the west road coming out of the fort and heading that way, joining, it seemed, another road that ran straight as an arrow from north to south, a Roman road, there was no doubting that. What Grettir had seen, though, was not just those roads, but close to that junction he could see smoke. Smoke rising from 50 or more fires, campfires from an army which early this morning would be cooking food and preparing for the march. An army of maybe 500 men, all invisible at this distance, but betrayed by the many smoke plumes. Samlin had marched that way the night before with 200 men. Now what had happened? Had he been joined by others? Had Ceredig of Elmet finally consented to go to war? Was this the army of Elmet paid for by my mother's jewellery, One-Eye's amber treasure? Was poor Mildred there amongst the enemy? Had Samlin touched her yet, or was he really planning to use her for his pleasure on the night they won the battle with us? Was Husser there too, gloating about his triumph and enjoying his half-sister's anguish? I closed my eyes and swore. "Ayla needs to be told. Come on," I said grimly, and pushed the pace even faster. We dropped down the slope, and the army was lost from sight. The horsemen, though, were not. They were now well ahead of us and starting to move back across the fields, trying to cut us off from the ford ahead of us. Looking that way, I felt hope rise, as it seemed they would not be able to reach us. The road was dipping down to a marshy plain that ran alongside the river. On the right side of the road, the ground was now level with us, but on the left, where the horsemen were coming from, the ground fell suddenly away, and I could see that ahead of us the road followed the edge of a cliff. It was only 50 feet or so high, but quite impassable to cavalry. Further ahead still, the cliff and the road dropped down to the level of the river, but it looked to me as if the marsh came right up to this point, effectually blocking off any access from the fields on our left up onto the road. As we got closer, however, my hope turned to fear, as I now could see that I was wrong. There was, in fact, the narrowest of gaps between the end of the cliff and the boggy ground. The marsh appeared to be full of deep pools that would prevent a horseman crossing. The cliff blocked them also, but there was a path of bare earth and clay running between them, no more than 5 feet wide. 5 feet, enough for two horses to pass abreast. That was where the horses were heading. That was where the danger lay. "Keep up the pace," I shouted to Edward, and then ran back to the rear of the company. As I ran past them, I could see from the wild eyes and pale faces of the women that many had seen the horses and knew that our chances of escape were small. When I reached the back of the column and looked at the Welsh warriors pursuing us, I grimaced, for I could see that our chances had just got even smaller. The Almatae following us on foot were now jogging along and were less than 50 paces behind us. They were close enough now for me to see the faces of the men who chased us, close enough for us to see the hungry expressions, and in particular the smug, expectant smiles. The Welsh had not simply come hurtling after us. No, indeed. They had been clever. Their leaders had known their land. They knew how the terrain lay up this road, and with the forces available to them, they had laid a trap for us. Soon, we would be smashed between a hammer and an anvil, the hammer of their heavy cavalry and the anvil of their shield wall. I flung a silent curse at Loki. The god was playing his tricks again, permitting us to escape and letting us feel we were safe, before finally allowing us to be caught a mere quarter of a mile from the river, the border with Daera, and safety. Unless we could reach the river first, then there was still a chance of escape. Well then, there was no time for hesitation. Every second counted now.
Run, I bellowed. Run like all the demons in the world are after you.
Run we did. Edward came and lifted Wallace onto his back and ran as fast as any of us, despite the burden. Even little Gwen, dragged along by her son, picked up her heels and scampered along. If we could keep the pace up, we might yet manage to escape. Then Loki laughed again, and I saw we were doomed. On the road ahead of us, the Welsh cavalry now stood. The hammer had arrived, and we were still 100 paces from the river. 100 paces, that was all, but it might as well have been a mile. We stopped running and, gasping for breath, awaited our fate. But one of us did not stop running. Aidan let go of his mother's hand and carried on towards the horses. Twisting his head round, he shouted back to us, "Come on, keep running. They are not all here yet. Keep running, you English bastards." Cuthbert pushed his way to the front and pointed. "He's right. There are only 3 of them on the road. Scouts ahead of the main squadron, I figure." I could see it now, and I glanced behind. The Welsh were less than 50 paces away, but in front, the hammer was not quite the threat I had thought. The other horses were coming, but they were still 100 paces away, moving into a narrow column to pass between the cliff and the marsh. Aidan was right. There was still a chance. "Run!" I shouted, and again we were off, lungs and throats burning. The company and the townsfolk ran straight at the 3 cavalry. Horsemen are a threat to infantry, and we fear them above all enemies. But not just 3 against 100. They knew it too, and as we closed on them, they spurred their mounts and veered away into the fields to the east. Meanwhile, Aidan was not running down the road. He had turned and headed into the little path between bog and cliff. There, he swung his shield round, drew his sword, and braced himself in the gap. The horsemen would have had to ride him down to get to the column. Edward and Grettir saw what he was doing and ran to join him. They had spears as well as shields and stood either side of him, overlapping his shield and dropping the spear points towards the coming horsemen. 3 more of the company joined them and formed a rear rank, Cuthbert, having managed to scavenge 6 arrows and notching 1 of them on the string, stood behind and to the side of them. The first of the company had reached the ford. I stopped them there, and we let the townsfolk start to cross. The Welsh were closing in, seemingly keen on revenge, and the rest of the company were milling about. I knew that I only had seconds to play with. "Shield wall! Form a shield wall now!" I shouted. It was the first time we had done this together since we practiced at the villa just a few days before, and they were all clumsy finding their places, but gradually our shield wall took shape. I started the wall just at the end of the cliff, so to protect our men on the path, and then slanted it across the road onto the bog beyond, angled to protect us from the 3 horsemen that were circling about over there and still posed a threat if they chose the right moment to attack. The Welsh foot soldiers had stopped running, and with a clattering of spears and shields were also forming up opposite us. Now we finally had the advantage. There were more of us, and we held a good position. The Almatae hammered weapons on shields and screamed abuse at us, goading us into attacking them. Some of the company moved forward, but I hauled them back. "Don't be bloody idiots, they just want us to attack. Stay still and let them come to us." I was not going to be a fool that way, but I was worried about the 1 weakness we did have. If the Welsh cavalry could break through the tiny group on the muddy path, they would be round behind our shield wall and would unleash a horror upon us. All now depended on Aidan and his 5 comrades. The pounding of iron, hooves and clay told me that the moment of decision had come. The horsemen had arrived. The leading one spurred his mount and shouted an incomprehensible war cry as, without hesitation, he charged towards Edward. His lance was long and sharp, and he targeted Edward's throat. Edward pulled up his shield, and the lance struck it hard, just above the centre, and the blow knocked Edward back, so that he ended up lying on top of the man behind. There was a cry of triumph, and the Welshman spurred on to ride them down. Aidan took one step forward and stabbed his sword hard straight up into the man's belly. The triumph now turned to horror, and then to agony. With a scream, he fell backwards. His horse, dragged over by the weight, reared up onto its hind legs. Edward, clambering back to his feet, brought up his spear and plunged it into the beast's groin. There was a gut-wrenching squeal of agony from the animal as it fell, with a crash back onto its rider, crushing him under it. It then lay on the ground, thrashing and writhing as its life poured out into the marsh besides the path. One hoof caught Aidan on the knee, and he screamed as his leg gave way. The next horseman arrived and made to jump over the still twitching body of the first horse, looking to land on Edward. As it left the ground, there was a twang, followed by another, and two arrows caught the rider in the throat. He fell off the horse and landed in a deep pool of muddy water in the bog. The weight of his armour pulled him down under the surface, where he choked on his own blood and drowned in the filthy water. His horse span round and headed back the way he had come, crashing into the column behind. In the resulting chaos, two more horses slid into the bog. Twang, 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 and three more arrows followed, all finding their mark, so four dead and dying horses blocked the narrow path. At last, the horses reined in and hung back. Cuthbert had one last arrow loaded, but he did not fire. Instead, he stood, aiming at the horses and waiting for them to come again. The Welsh shield wall had fallen silent. They had been expecting the cavalry to break through. Now that that had failed, I could see their leader studying us and counting our numbers. Was he going to try an attack, hoping that the horses would still find a gap to break through after all? Out in the field, the three scouts moved over to talk to him, and I could see that they were pointing across the river. I bent my neck round to look that way, but at first I saw nothing. Then there was movement, 30 spearmen, moving down the roads towards the ford from the other side. I had an anxious moment as I thought of that army we had seen earlier. Was this part of it already in Deira and coming to cut us off? Then I saw that with the spearmen there were some of the townsfolk from Wixton. They were leading what I could now see were plainly fellow Deiran warriors towards us. With a splash they were across the river behind us, and I went to their leader, a severe-looking bold man who looked at me sceptically as we approached. "Where's your lord?" he asked. "Here he is," I said, pointing at Wallace, who was sitting on the road looking exhausted and only just conscious. "But he's been injured. His lieutenant was killed at Calcaria, So the lad took over. Did it bloody marvellously, actually. Saved us all," Wallace said weakly, and then struggling to his feet he staggered over to us. "But you saved us all now, my lord," I hesitated, not knowing who the man was. "Earl Harold, of Eyre Forwick," he answered. "It looks like the danger is over," he added, nodding his head towards the Welsh who were backing off down the road. In the fields to the west the cavalry were also retreating, leaving half a dozen dead men on the path and in the marsh. I blew out a long breath. The enemy finally knew that they could not beat us today, so we were safe. I went and helped Wallace, and together we led the company across the river and back into Deira. When we reached the far side, I turned back to see Aidan limping across, surrounded by men from the company, who were clapping him on the back.
"For a Welsh bastard, you were pretty good there," Edward said to him, and with a wink at me he carried on down the road after the company.
Grettir hung back and stood looking at Aidan, not saying anything. Suddenly, he nodded his head at the lad, the closest that the gruff old teacher ever got to saying he had been wrong about a man. Aidan had proved his worth, the nod said. He glanced at me and tilted his head for a moment, acknowledging that I had been right. Then he turned away. In a moment, I was left alone with Aidan. "Well then, I went to Elmet to find and probably kill you, but you saved us all. I thank you for that. For a slave, you sure know how to fight," I added. Aidan looked pained now, reminded again that here, on this side of the river, that's all he was, a slave. He tossed the sword down into the road. "You'd better take that. You know what your father says about slaves having weapons." I reached down and picked up the sword, then studied him for a moment. Finally, I made up my mind. I turned the weapon round and handed him the hilt. "Take it. You've earned it," I said. "But your father..." "Take it," I repeated, and this time he did. "I will deal with my father," I added, and together we walked down the road. Chapter 12. The Council of Ayla. Earl Harold led us along the road to Eyre Forwick, then halted in the first settlement we came to, a tiny village with just a couple of dozen hovels clustered around the headman's hut. One hovel doubled as a run-down alehouse. Here, he allowed us to get rest, get a meal, dress our wounds, and in many cases, to grab a few hours' sleep. A little later in the day, he came and found Wallace and I in the corner of the alehouse. Lila and Grettir were examining his arm, afraid that the traumas of our ordeal brought the risk of infection, or worse, gangrene. When they had unwrapped it, we could all see that it was almost black with bruises and agonisingly stiff, but he did not smell or look infected. So, they strapped it up again, and Wallace sat back on the bench, leant against the wall, and took a long draught of his ale. After some broth and a tankard of ale, Wallace was more alert than he had been since his brutal attack from Samlin. Harold's face was dark when he sat down opposite Wallace. "How's the arm, Wallace?" he asked.
"Hurts like buggery, but I'll live, for now, anyway," Wallace said, and took another sup of his mug.
"Glad to hear it. Right then, I came to tell you that after Curdic here told me about that army you had seen in Elmet, I sent our scouts, and they confirmed that there is indeed a force of over 400 spears camped just the other side of the border, close to the Roman road."
"I wonder what he's planning," Wallace mused, as he wiped the bowl with bread, chewed on it, then swilled it down with more ale.
He frowned and looked up at Harold.
"Is there any news about Owen and where he is?"
Harold shook his head. "Last thing I heard, he was still in Regid, but his army is getting bigger each day, all the rumours say, so it can't be long now."
"But where? Where will they attack?"
Harold shrugged. "I have no idea, but the king might. That's the other thing I came to tell you. He must know of Samlin One-Eye's army as quickly as possible. I was about to head off anyway. Just yesterday I received a summons to God Nundingham. Ayla is calling a great council. Everyone expects he will call out the Fjord, and then it will be war."
"We're already at war, Harold," Wallace said.
Harold grunted and then nodded. He finished off his own tankard and got up to leave. "Get your men ready, Wallace," he said. Then raising his voice so everyone in the tavern could hear, he added, "We will march within the hour to the King's Hall." There was some groaning at the thought of setting out again, for more than just one of the company, but a scowl from Wallace silenced them, and the men went back to their meals or muttered curses into their ale. As a young man, Ayla had conquered the Welsh kingdom of Eberarkum, including their prize, the capital, the city he would call Eorforwic. Eorforwic was a rich city, and probably the most important city in the north. However, Ayla did not rule from there. He held court not far from Wixton, in his halls at Godnundingham. It was to this stronghold that we now marched. The road we were on went northeast to Eorforwic, and as we marched along I grew excited with anticipation at seeing the city. I was to be disappointed, because before we reached it, Harold led us down a branching road that headed east. It cut off a big loop that we would have had otherwise have been forced to take north of the city and back to the southeast, and we could save 10 miles and several hours this way. The king's summons had been urgent, and Harold had no time to permit my sightseeing. It took the balance of that day and most of the next to reach Wixton. Harold allowed us to stop there overnight and let the townsfolk go home. As we came close to the town, a shriek of joy ran out from the tannery, which was a couple of hundred yards to the north. Two auburn-haired teenage girls rushed over to us, and over to their mother, and threw themselves at her, hugging her tightly to them. The tanner himself, limping from a wound he had taken defending his family from the raid, joined them, and we passed them by and left them to their joy. Then, it was as if this was an alarm signal to rouse the town, for suddenly the road ahead was full of people. They came out of their houses and workshops and walked towards the company, searching the faces we brought with us, some expectant, some not daring to hope until they had seen the ones they looked for. Soon, though, the tears of sorrow and joy started. Joy for those we had saved, and sorrow for those we had left behind in a foreign land. Sorrow aside, for the most part, the people of Wixton wanted to hold a great feast to welcome their families, and us, home. But then, when they were told that the fighting was not yet over, and indeed that the war was probably just beginning, their exuberance subsided for a while. In the end, though, it was as if everyone decided to take what happiness they could today, uncertain of the approaching weeks and what they would bring. And soon the alehouses were full and the beer flowing. Edward, Cuthbert and I were drinking ale and eating bread in the Wolf's Head Tavern, whilst we waited for the orders to resume our march, when Father found me. Wallace had sent a message to him about the royal summons. He rushed over and embraced me. It had been 4 days since I had last seen him, and he was moving about much easier now, and although his scars were still ugly, they were beginning to fade. He sat down and asked the question that I was dreading.
"Mildred?"
he asked. I shook my head and saw the blood drain from his face. "She's alive, father, but Samlin had taken her with him to his army. I tried to find her, but she was gone when I got there." He stared at me, his mouth moving, but no words coming. "Is she, I mean, did he touch her?" I shook my head. "No, and I don't think he will, not yet at least. I told him about Samlin's boast. I will find her, father, I promise." He nodded his head and reached out and put a hand on mine and squeezed it.
"We both will."
Suddenly his eyes widened in anger and he pushed past me with a roar. The tavern noise ceased in an instant and all eyes turned at the cause of the commotion. Aidan had come into the room, and on seeing him, father had burst across it, and in an instant he had the lad by the neck pinned up against the far wall. Tightening his grip, he reached for his hunting knife and placed the blade against Aidan's throat. "Master, please," Aidan croaked.
"Treacherous snake, I'll slit your throat and feed you to the ravens."
"Father, I..." My father turned a face that was red with fury towards me.
"What are you doing, Curdick? Sitting on your arse, drinking ale, while this piece of horseshit is walking around?"
Then he saw that Aidan was wearing a sword, and his face grew redder.
"Walking around with a sword? Have you lost your senses? This turd betrayed us. Woden's balls, but I'm going to rip out his guts.
He's the reason Mildred is gone." I grasped his wrist and forced the knife away from Aidan's throat. "No, father, he's not," I said calmly.
"What crap is this?"
My father's face was now almost purple, and his eyes bulging. I knew how terrible his anger could get, and my heart was pounding like the galloping hoofs of the Almaty cavalry, but I had to try and explain. "It's not crap, it's the truth. Aidan did not betray us, it was..." I hesitated now, thinking to mention Husser, but then feeling that this was not the best time. "It was not Aidan anyway. No, he left the villa to find his parents. He rescued us in Elmet. If it was not for him, I would be dead now. That is why I gave him a sword. He earned it."
"Earned it? Are you mad? He's a slave."
"No, father, he's not. I freed him." At that, my father actually let go of Aidan and turned to stare at me.
"You make him free with my property, boy," he finally said with a deep growl. "Cuthwin has not been dead a week, and now you go on as if I'm dead too."
I shook my head. I was scared of the old man. He had a ferocious temper if he felt disrespect. I rarely stood up to him that often before, but I would today. "No, father, it's not like that. Aidan rescued us. He fought with us and helped us free the prisoners, and then was a hero when we got away. He took that sword off a man he killed, and it's his by right. I will obey you in anything you say, but," I gritted my teeth, "but Aidan remains free." He stared at me for a full minute, and around me I could hear men shuffling their feet awkwardly. Glancing at them, though, I saw that none of them were looking away, and indeed they were all staring at us, fascinated by this exchange. This was the Wixton Company, and I had led them for a day and brought them home. But I was still a lad, and they wanted to know what guts I really had.
"If I agree, if I free him, what will he do? Where will his loyalty be?" father said, now looking at Aidan. Aidan said nothing, although he seemed to be thinking about the question himself, but I answered first. "If you ask him for loyalty, then that is a question for after you free him, not before. Loyalty and fealty can only come from a free man." Father nodded.
"Good answer, I suppose," he admitted with a grudging respect. "So you're a hero, are you, Aidan?"
Aidan shrugged. "Too bloody right I am, my lord. But what I want is, I just want to kill that one-eyed bastard. My father is dead at his hand, or at least he did nothing to prevent it, and I just want revenge."
"On Samlin?" Aidan nodded. "That's a good answer too," father mused, rubbing his cheek. "Very well then. Aidan, son of Carefid the Welshman, I release you from slavery. You're a free man, as these men here will witness." Aidan nodded and smiled. He then drew his sword, but I felt my father tense, expecting a blow. Aidan looked straight at my father's eyes, and then, suddenly, he knelt in front of him and offered him up the hilt of his sword. "I, Aidan, son of Carefid, swear loyalty to your house and your heirs, and offer my sword in your service. I will go where you will, but I ask to go with Master Curdick and to go to war." Then he stood up.
That's all we need, a bloody Welshman in the army, Edward said into his ale, but loud enough for us all to hear. Aidan smiled, and suddenly the tavern was full of laughter again. Harold let the men sleep late the following day, but by early afternoon we set off again, led by Harold and Wallace. Wallace's arm was still in a sling, and he was sitting on his horse a little stiffly, but he was alert and looking better than he had just 2 days before. Northeast we went, with father walking with us this time. We spoke of mother and St. Eva and how worried they were, now all the family had left. Father's voice faltered whenever he mentioned Cuthwin or Mildreth, and despite the spring day, I too grew mournful and maudlin. I was not sure how to tell him about Huss's part in the raid, but I just had to. I took a deep breath. Father, you know I told you that Aidan was not the traitor, and that it was not him that told Samlin about Mother's jewellery. He looked across at me as we continued to walk side by side.
Yes?
Well, I've not told you who did betray us, have I? He frowned and then shook his head. Well, I did not mention this in front of the men in the tavern, but we know who betrayed us. He stopped walking and put a hand on my shoulder.
Go on, tell me. Who was it then?
Hussa, I replied. He recoiled at the name of his son. Then he just stared at me, shaking his head.
No, he said at last, unable to accept what he was being told.
Hussa, father. It was Hussa. So, as we resumed the march, I now gave an account of all that had occurred in Calcaria. When I had finished, he was silent for many minutes, staring away from me at the fields that we passed.
Very well, he said at last. Leave Hussa to me. I will deal with him. He is my responsibility.
We will deal with him together, father, I replied.